Welcome to Discovery 1, Module 1, Part 2. And this morning we will be continuing on the lecture that we started last week. And before we're going to do anything else, we're going to take any outstanding questions from people who may have them before we get started on the content. And I believe the first person with a question was Glenn, who's asking about feedback.
Once the assessments are completed, what's the process about getting specific feedback? I'm concerned about problems I'm having understanding their style of grammar or the way questions are asked or the way the questions are presented, rather than as much technical difficulties, if you like.
We don't generally do individual feedback for students because there'd be 40 students times one session of individual feedback, which usually takes 3 to 5 minutes per question multiplied by 20. But in certain situations, we can certainly sit and go through a couple of the exams with you, say chapter 1 and chapter 2, for example, and that might give you a bit of a hint as to how the questions are posted and how they behave. There are the exam answers, which once you've completed an exam, I can email you a URL to the exam answers where the questions are read out, the correct answer is given, and then the correct answer is briefly discussed, if that would be of assistance also. So that would be a very low involvement method. Initially, we could give you the answer question and answers for the first exam or whatever if you've completed it. Otherwise, we can certainly sit down and pull open the assessment viewer and go through an exam or two with you to get you to get the idea of how the exams are set out. Unfortunately, every certification body has their own way of doing exams, and they all have their own bizarre grammar and question style, and it sort of is part of the getting used to the way that materials delivered as to how they decide to deliver the assessment material.
Well, I did find their grammar bizarre, to say the least, so if you could send me that URL, I would really appreciate that. Thanks.
We can. Has anybody else had any problem with the grammar and stuff of the exams? We're not trying to single you out as the only person who's having a problem there, Glenn, but we'd like to know if anybody else has had trouble understanding the questions. Alrighty, well, we'll send you that URL and we will assist you and see if we can get you to get into how the stuff is written. They do have interesting sentence structure, but I guess I've been doing the exams since about 2002, so I'm somewhat used to it. Okay, does anybody else have any pending questions before we get started on the lecture material proper? Now, if I ask if anybody has any questions and stuff, you're all welcome to type no into the chat window, and I will move on. But that's all good. Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's what we need. Okay. It just means I don't have to sit there waiting to see if anybody has any questions, whatever. Now. It goes without saying, and although we've posted to the mailing lists and we have mentioned it and we've been over it and over it, I'm going to mention it here for the recordings for anybody who's going through the archives. We apologise for the spam yesterday that turned up on the announce list. It wasn't from us. And at the moment, emergency list moderation is in effect, which means it will take time for any messages you post to the discuss lists to be approved, because we need to hand approve each message. So if you post to Cavi Discuss and your message does not show up straight away, it is waiting for an administrator to approve it. We apologize for that, but it will just about 100% guarantee that you will not receive another unintended message on the lists for the time being. Okay, I'll just flip AutoVox on and then we'll get started on the course content. Now, now it's up to you guys, but I posted a message to the discuss list last week about the transfer calculations on Ventrilo. Did everybody understand that, or did it all look a bit confusing?
I thought it was good. It was useful.
Okay. We have two people with a confusing and another three or four with an okay. So let's go over it briefly. Not the actual calculations there, but we will go over it briefly again because there is actually a worksheet in Chapter 5 where you guys have to do this, and I do have the time to talk briefly about it for now. So I will go over it briefly and try and explain how it works, and then we'll move on to the rest of the material in today's lecture. So if you understand it, catch five winks. Okay, if we are looking at, say, speed measurements, for example, in America you guys tend to measure speed in, say, miles per hour. Or if you're in Australia, you measure in kilometres per hour. Now, those speed things are one unit over another. So, in other words, how many kilometres you travel in a particular hour, or how many miles you travel in a particular hour. Everybody cool with that? Thank you. Okay. Now, the same holds true for the transfer of data. Now, there are two types of bandwidth. There is analog bandwidth, which says how much frequency or analog signals you can transfer over a line, and then there is digital bandwidth, which is what we are talking about here. Now, digital bandwidth is usually measured, the base rate for digital bandwidth is measured in bits per second, or lowercase bps. Whereas if they have uppercase BPS, we are measured in bytes per second. Okay. Now, for the example here, I'm going to use bytes per second because it's just an easier measure to use for our example. If a link could transfer 2,000 bytes per second. If a link could transfer 2,000 bytes per second, how much would we transfer in 10 seconds?
20,000.
2,000 times 10, is that correct?
That's correct. 2,000 times 10, which would be 20,000 bytes. Okay, well, let's take another example. Curtis, and I'm not picking on you, but anybody else who's confusing. If you have the capacity to drink... if you have the capacity to drink 3 beers an hour, how many beers would you have drunk in 2 hours? We have a 6 from Rosie, which is correct. Does everybody understand how this works? We multiply the number of beers by the number of hours. Now, by the time you've had 6 beers, you probably can't multiply it, okay? But we're just for our example, we're going to pretend that you still can, okay? So we've had 6 beers and we're all quite happy. Now, when you're calculating... this is an equation, so the equation is basically total size equals, the total size is equal to the number of bytes times the time. And you can flip that equation around to get different things out of the equation. And this is sort of a bit of mathematics, which we don't sort of heavily go into. But basically, all I did for the Ventrilo calculations was to look at how many bytes per second the Ventrilo server was using, and that's written at the bottom of your setup window, which is accessible with your JAWS cursor, mouse cursor, review cursor, whatever you want to call it. And I multiplied that by the number of seconds in an hour, which meant, and can anybody tell me how many seconds there are in an hour?
3,600.
There are 3,600. There are 60 seconds in a minute, and there are 60 seconds in an hour. So 60 times 60 is 6 by 6 is 36, and 2 zeros is 3,600. So all we did was we took the number of bytes per second and we multiplied it by 3,600, and that gave us the amount of bandwidth that was used in an hour. And then I did some other calculations under that to show that the lectures usually run for an hour and a half, and how much that would be if we were running for an hour and a half. Now, the key to these calculations is to convert all of your units to the same units. So if you are working in bytes per second, you need to convert everything to bytes, the units of size, and you need to convert all of your time units to seconds, otherwise you can't do the multiplication. Okay. Now, to convert megabits to megabytes per second, you divide by 8, and to convert megabytes per second to megabits, you multiply by 8. And can anybody tell me why that is the case?
There are 8 bits in a byte.
That is correct. A byte, generally speaking, has 8 bits, and most of the bytes that you're likely to come across have 8 bits in them. Okie dokie. Now, we spoke last week about a bit being the smallest piece of information that a computer could send or receive or deal with, and that is a logic state 0 or 1, or a light switch off or on sort of thing. So that's binary simplified, and that we said that if we had 8-bit collections, they were called bytes, and generally characters were expressed in ASCII, the American Standard Code for Information Interchange. And then Drew, just to be difficult, asked about UTF-8. Did you end up finding out what UTF-8 was, Drew? Is he even on this morning? I think he might be.
Yeah, I'm here, and I didn't, sorry.
Oh, you're a loss. That's okay. You can Wikipedia that up later. I've got more windows open than the modernly designed building. Okay, here we go. We're back to our notes. Now, the only reason I posted that thing about the Ventrilo bandwidth usage was we did have a question from a student who wanted to know how much listening to a lecture would take. And I hope for their benefit that I managed to answer that question. I was just a little bit more long-winded about it than general because I figured you guys could do with a worked example rather than me just putting the... and there's Mr. Murray who's connected. Are you allowed to?
No, it's Ian Dot Murray now.
Oh, okay. Okay, now the other thing that's probably worth mentioning is that when we're dealing with networking signals, which is essentially what this course is about, the networking stuff has to be carried across media or over a medium. And some of the examples of medium we have are cables, as in copper cables, wireless signals, and optical fiber. Now, has anyone not seen any of these? You can't see wireless, but some of you may have used wireless. Have all of you seen sort of network cables and things? I mean, there are different sorts of network cables. There's twisted pair, which is the one that's commonly used in a lot of home installations. It is 4 pairs of copper wire twisted around each other with a certain number of twists per inch or per meter, depending on how they measure it, and those twists are used to attempt to cancel out electromagnetic interference and protect the cable from external interference. Has anyone not seen a twisted pair network cable? Okay. A twisted pair cable usually has an RJ45 connector on the end of them, which is a square connector with 8 contacts on one side and a little squeezy thing that you press in to release the cable from the socket. And often the cables are like a phone jack, except it's the big one. There's an 11, there's a 12, and there's a 45. And the 45 is about, I'm not sure exactly the exact measurements, but it's about maybe a quarter inch across, maybe a bit smaller than a quarter inch. I'd have to look up the exact measurements. And you push the cables into the socket and they go click. And in fact, if you've got a cable running from your workstation to the wall at your work, it's probably going to be an RJ45 connector. I would, however, warn you, though, possibly don't go ripping the network cable out without checking with your IT department, or if you are going to rip it out, make sure you know how to put it back, otherwise you won't have any network connectivity. That sounds a bit silly, but you do have to tell some people these things. Okay, optical fiber is cable, is glass fibers. There are two types of optical fiber. There is single mode fiber, and there is multi-mode fiber, which we cover more later in the module. Single mode fiber tends to use lasers, and multi-mode fiber tends to use just regular infrared LEDs. It is worth noting that fiber optics uses light in the infrared range, which means it is invisible. So don't go staring in the end of a fiber. Even if you are blind, it's likely to burn your eyeballs out, and that's quite unpleasant. There are usually more than one fiber per cable. In fact, usually the cables are quite thick and they carry quite a number of fibers in them. One fiber is usually used for sending data, and the other fiber is used for receiving data. Single mode fiber can generally go longer distances than multi-mode fiber, but it is also more expensive to lay and run. Any questions so far? Righto. Now, how are people going with the labs? I've seen a few come back, and I've marked them, and I hope you've all received your marks, except for Richard Stebner, who's on Comcast. I need to email you separately because Comcast hates me. So if you can try and send your labs from another email address, you're likely to get a reply quicker, but I will email you from an alternate address and tell you that you passed all your labs. So there you go, you passed all the labs you submitted to me, but Comcast wouldn't let me email you that.
Okay, thanks, Carrie. Eventually, maybe this week, I'll probably put together a Gmail address.
Yeah, Comcast really doesn't like us, even though I am actually reverse mappable, and even though the mail exchanger records do point at my host, and even though my forward map and my reverse map are the same, they still don't like me. So anybody on Comcast will have trouble getting mail from us. We will try and send from an alternate address, but if you can set up a Gmail, that would probably be useful. And just a note to anybody setting up a Gmail, if you tick the box in the preferences pane, you can access your Gmail using IMAP, which means you will see the same messages in your Gmail from whatever computer you check it from if you check it with IMAP. So handy dandy hint. Okay, Amando, optical fiber is often used for long haul links where you need to go between buildings or you need to go quite a few kilometres and stuff. It's used in cities and things. Because fiber is glass fiber, it is not conductive, and it doesn't have the same problems with being hit by lightning and stuff that, say, copper cables would have. The maximum length for twisted pair cables, generally speaking, is 100 metres or 328 feet. 100 metres or 328 feet. 100 metres or 328 feet. Can you guess that that's going to be in the exam? Okay, good. Maximum length for twisted pair is 100 metres, 328 feet. If you're using an audio player to listen to your lecture, bookmark now. The recommendations are 90 metres from the wiring closet to the wall panel, and a maximum of 10 metres from the wall panel to the PC, in other words, the patch leads, and we will go into those wall panels and stuff later on in the modules. Okay, now the notes diverge, and they talk about the screen resolution. And screen resolution is measured in pixels, width times height. Okay, and I realise we are lecturing in the lobby today. I apologise for that, but hey, we've started, so I can't see the point of moving. Okay, and I've seen a lot of people retrieve their labs, send me their labs containing all the resolution information. Now, this might sound really obvious, but I'm going to mention it anyway, because I don't expect everybody to know this. But generally speaking, the higher the resolution, the more dots per inch, and the smaller stuff looks. Okay, so the higher the resolution, the smaller stuff looks. And that's important because as our population ages, you will tend to find that there are a whole lot of people who do not like running their computer at the top resolution because the text is just too small and the fonts are too small. If I had a dollar for everybody that wanted me to turn on large fonts, once I'd put them up to 1024x768, I'd probably be richer than Gates. So keep that in mind. Yes, Rosie.
I would think it would be the opposite because you've got more space to display things. You've got more space to work with. Why is it that things look smaller? Is there some sort of scientific or logical reason for that?
Oh, certainly. The more pixels you have on a line, the closer the pixels have to be together. So if you have 800 pixels on a line and the line is 8 inches long, you've got 100 pixels per inch. But if you've got 1600 pixels on a line, on the same 8 inch line, then you're now looking at 200 pixels in the same inch. So the higher the resolution, the closer together the pixels are. And unless you actually enlarge the fonts, most fonts are set to be a certain number of pixels high. So as the pixels get closer and closer together, the fonts get smaller and smaller.
Makes sense.
That's what I like to hear. And if it doesn't, I'm quite happy to explain other bits and pieces, but we like it when it makes sense. Now, the other thing that's worth mentioning too is that generally speaking, LCDs have a native resolution that they are meant to run at. And if you run outside that native resolution, the screen does not look as good as it would as if you are running in the native resolution. And we had an interesting problem recently that's worth mentioning. I think it's Acer are selling LCDs over here in Australia for, I think, $155, and then you get like a $60 cash back or whatever, and the monitor ends up costing you $92. This is for an 18.5-inch flat panel LCD for $92, so you can see that people are quite interested in that. However, the native resolution of the LCD is something like 1366 by 800 and something, and unless you've got really recent video drivers, a lot of the old video cards will not handle the oddball resolution, so buyer be warned. And the LCD screen does not look cool if it's not in its native resolution. Okay, anybody got any questions on resolutions and monitors and things before we move on? I know it may sound a bit bizarre to go on about monitors, but I figure that, yes, Stacey. Generally speaking, it's written in the monitor manual, which you can get somebody to flip through and have a look at, or you can Google up the specifications of the model of monitor you've got. Generally speaking, though, most monitors are plug-and-play monitors, and if your video card supports plug-and-play, and most do, Windows will automatically set the resolution to the native resolution 9 times out of 10. Okay, now, digital cameras, they measure their res in megapixels, and that's the number of million pixels that the camera records when you take a still frame. Okay, so the digital cameras measure their res in megapixels, and generally speaking, the higher the megapixels, the sharper and clearer the pixels the pictures are, although it also depends on your lens and the quality of the cameras, and this is not Discovery One into digital cameras, so we don't go much further into it than that. I can probably tell you, though, without too much confusion, that you really do get what you pay for. If you buy a 10 megapixel digital camera for $100, don't expect too much. Also, it is also possible to get better stuff out of your digital camera if you've got certain models of digital camera by putting it into what we call RAW mode, which means that the pictures are not compressed into JPEG, and if you do that, you can actually get quite high quality pictures at the expense of storage space. But if you know enough about how to get your camera into RAW mode, I don't need to tell you anything, so we'll move on. Okay, the next terminal, the next topic we need to explain is Hertz, H-E-R-T-Z. Can anybody tell me what a what a hertz is.
It's measured in cycles per second.
It is measured in cycles per second, Leone. That's very well done. And what is measured in cycles per second? And that's a question to anyone.
It's a measurement of the waveform from the crossing the zero line.
Yeah, what were you going to say, Drew? Was that essentially what you were going to say?
Pretty much, yes.
Okie dokie. Now, you probably heard the term waveform, and everybody's just gone, waveform? We haven't heard about waveforms. Okay, there are certain things that travel in waves. You tend to see the ocean is a good example. You've heard the term waves. That's good. That's jolly good. Okay, so ocean waves, and they're those things that crash on the beach and dump you very painfully with your boogie board. There are sound waves, which hurt your ears if they're too loud. There are radio waves, which, okay, you know, you're listening to the radio and your radio converts the radio waves back into sound waves. And the frequency of a wave is measured in cycles per second or hertz. Can anybody tell me what is special about 440 hertz? No, Scott Erickson, you are exempt. Yes, Drew.
I think that's a bit.
That's the pitch of, I believe, A. That's what most violinists tune to.
Yes, standard tuning, and yes, we can argue about the fact that if you're in certain concert halls that A really isn't at 440, it's at 423.5, and then at other halls it's at 430. But standard tuning is 440, okay? So that's musical A. Now, obviously, the approximate range of human hearing is approximately from about 30 hertz up to about 16 kilohertz, and as you get older, the top end of your hearing drops off, and you can't hear things at 15, 16 kilohertz anymore. Anybody here used to be able, or can still hear, TV squeal on CRT TVs? Have we still got anybody who can hear that? Yeah, I can still hear that. Okay, cool. Okay, now, we then go into frequencies that are thousands of cycles per second, and they are called kilohertz. And we then have millions of cycles per second, which is called megahertz. And then we have a gigahertz. And I think there's a nice breakdown in your notes of the electromagnetic spectrum, but you'll find that if we're dealing with electromagnetic radiation, we deal with different frequencies such as visible light, microwaves, radio waves, infrared, and all of those sorts of things. Okay. Now, and you'll notice, for example, that if you're listening to your FM radio station, they'll sometimes come on with something like, you're listening to 102.3 dodgy FM, and you go, well, that's 102.3 megahertz, which refers to the frequency, the base frequency of the carrier of the FM signal. It's a bit more complicated than that because we're dealing with FM, but essentially that's the thing where you spin the dial until it says a 102.3, and then you can listen to your favourite radio station. Okay, CB being on 27 megahertz approximately, amateur bands being sandwiched in between about 3.5 and 30 megahertz for HF, and then there are various other bands such as UHF, VHF, etc., etc., etc. Okay, now a wave starts at a zero point, it goes up to a peak, it then returns to a zero point, it then goes down to its bottom peak, or trough I should say, and it then returns to the zero point. And it's the number of full cycles that the wave makes per second that is our definition of hertz. Now, for those who've turned up for the Fundy visit for ITE1, I apologise that this isn't a lot of material that you'll necessarily need to cover, but it will come in handy later on, let me assure you. So, apologies in advance. Now, any questions on that so far? Okay, so essentially, and one thing I will mention here briefly, is that you have the frequency of the wave, and you also have the wavelength of the wave, which is how long from the zero point to the zero point, and the wavelength is directly proportional to the frequency. So as the frequency, hang on, no, it's inversely proportional to the frequency. As the frequency increases, the wavelength decreases. And you can approximately calculate the wavelength of a wave by dividing 300 by the frequency of the signal in megahertz, which means if you divide 300 by 27, you get something around 10.5, but that basically puts the CB radio on the 11 meter band. The wavelength is important because to get an antenna to resonate well with a signal, you basically have to have the antenna being a multiple of the wavelength of the signal, and that's about all we're going to say about that. But essentially, the lower the frequency, the bigger your antenna has to be, which is why 2.4 gigahertz stuff tends to have aerials that are about 3 or 4 inches long, because that's quite long enough to handle the wavelength at 2.4 gigahertz. Anybody want to add or say anything on any of that at this point before I start talking about computers and various quality of components? Okie dokie. Now, we also have some activities that you guys are going to do at some point, although Grace is the one with all the activities and she is currently travelling back in, so there will probably be a quiz and an exercise that we'll all do a little bit later when Grace turns up once she's finished travelling all the way back into the association. So we apologise in advance for that, but her Braille Sense Plus is not here, and that's where the activities are. Okay, a computer is as good as its components. Now, that all sounds a bit straightforward, doesn't it? But you would be surprised how many people ask me why the computer at the local electrical store is on special for $4.99, and that's a good price, and my mate just paid $2,000 for his computer. There surely isn't any difference between the $4.99 computer and the $2,000 computer. Think again. You tend to get what you pay for. Unless, of course, you're being taken for a ride. And I have a good adage that tends to cover this stuff. Good, fast, cheap, pick two. And that's generally my philosophy as far as building computers. Has anybody had any experience with shoddy computer components?
Yep.
I've certainly had my fair choice of interesting experiences. Oh, good. Well, keep buying good stuff and you might escape that experience. Okay. Now, where are my notes? Here we are. Now, obviously, the things we need to talk about as far as computers are concerned in the notes here are motherboard or system board, which is the politically correct way of referring to them now, but we're still going to say motherboard. The CPU and the RAM. Now, the motherboard or system board is the main circuit board in a computer that contains the buses and the socket for the CPU and the sockets for the RAM and all of the connectors that you plug your hard drives and your floppy drives and all that sort of stuff in. And the CPU is the central processing unit, which usually plugs into a socket or slot on the system board. And you've got a heatsink and fan to cool the CPU. Interesting story about that, actually. We had somebody who was putting together a Cyrix P200 Plus. I don't know whether anybody's been in computers long enough to remember the Cyrix range of chips. They were the cheap alternative to the Intels back about 2000. Yeah. I had a couple of them. They were quite good, except their floating point performance was pretty dismal. And this guy put the whole computer together, powered it up, and found that the computer crashed after about 1 or 2 minutes of being powered up. And I sort of said to him, "Oh, you did put the fan on that came with that chip, didn't you?" And he said, "Oh, no, that'd be the thing that's in this box here." And I said, "Well, be careful, because that chip will be a bit hot," and he'd just burnt his finger on the surface of the chip that was red hot from not having a fan on it. Suffice it to say, he went and ran his finger under a bit of cold water, and we then put on the heatsink goo and the heatsink and the fan, and funnily enough, the computer ran a lot cooler after the processor was adequately cooled. Okay, any questions, comments, add-ins at this point? Yeah, it sort of ran for about, as I said, 1 to 2 minutes, and then the CPU reached critical temperature and the whole thing latched up. I mean, obviously, modern processors tend to have thermal protection and thermal monitoring, and the processor will often reduce clock speed or shut down completely in extreme thermal conditions. And that's probably a good thing. I thought that AMD had some thermal monitoring in them, or is that usually left to the motherboard chipset?
In my experience, they do.
Yeah, the newer AMD stuff has thermal monitoring in it now. Everything since the Athlon 64 stuff has thermal monitoring. It never used to, but generally there is also temperature measurer that's in under the socket, and that's hooked into the LM sensors, the environmental sensors that'll tell you the temperatures and fan speeds and stuff on your system board. And most system board manufacturers tend to include software that will read off those settings and stuff, so that you can monitor the health of your system. No, Jonathan, we can't exclusively say that stuff made in a certain country is necessarily bad. There's actually some quite good stuff that's made in Taiwan and Singapore and Asia and stuff, and there's also some quite bad stuff made in those particular countries and Korea and stuff. It really depends on how much you pay for the gear and whether the seller of the gear is reputable. You tend to find that Asus, for example, has some quite good gear, but they work out of Taiwan. So you certainly see both sides of the manufacturing spectrum, depending on what price you're willing to pay. You'll also tend to find, though, that if it's often too good to be true, then if it's too good to be true, it often isn't. And if you get something really, really cheap, you will tend to find that it doesn't behave very well. As Glenn found out the other day, or a while ago, when he got a cheap battery off eBay for a mobile phone, which I believe lasted 6 weeks, if my remembrance of the anecdote is correct.
Correct.
And a number of us have done that and have got things from various places nice and cheap, and they haven't perhaps behaved as well as we would have liked them to.
But it cost $3.
Wow, you got your $3 out of it. Yeah. Okay, the next thing the notes want us to talk about is selecting your CPU. And that's the type of the CPU, the manufacturer of the CPU, and the speed of the CPU. Now, a big hint for all of you studying ITE 1, the form factor of the case, the CPU, and the RAM all have to match. Actually, sorry, it was case, CPU, and power supply, I should say. I just got that wrong. Case, CPU, and power supply. So if you're doing that worksheet in ITE1, I believe it's case, CPU, and power supply. All have to be the same form factor. And we talk about form factors in ITE1. We don't tend to talk about them in Discovery. So I'd refer you to ITE1, Lecture 1, which will be up on the website if you're interested in form factors.
I thought it was the motherboard that has the form factor, the processor has the socket type.
Yes, but the processor has to suit the system board, and the system board has to suit the case. And it's possible to have the form factor of the system board be different, so you need to put the right form factor system board in the right sort of case. Most modern systems are ATX form factor, although there are some little ones that are mini ITX, and there are certain other form factors that you will tend to see in the market. Yes, Rosie.
I'm sorry. It's the case, the power supply, and what's the third one?
The case, the power supply, and the CPU,
okay.
I believe.
All I needed to know.
Sorry, Josh? Yeah, that's what I thought. Case, power supply, and motherboard all have to match the same form factor. Oh, I've just become exceedingly confused. So, if you're confused, it's case, motherboard, and power supply. Is that right? Yes, case, power supply, motherboard. Right, good. But the CPU has to go with the motherboard, so that just makes it even more complicated, okay? So you've got to make sure the CPU suits your motherboard and that you can put the right CPU into the right motherboard, and that's often harder than it should be.
Same with the RAM.
Pretty much. The motherboard you buy will tend to determine the sort of RAM you can put in it, and the chipset on the motherboard often has a limit on how much RAM it can take and of what sort of RAM it can take. So some motherboards will take DDR2, some will take DDR3, some will take, if you've got some old system boards, they'll tend to take DDR memory. Older boards than that took SDRAM, and the ones older than that took SIMS, and the ones older than that took DIPS. But if you've got motherboards with DIPS on them and you're not using them for something really, really important, I'd be putting them out on the verge for bulk refuse because they're pretty old. We're talking about different types of adapter cards. There's video cards, there's sound cards, there's network interface cards, modems, controller cards, etc. They connect into various types of slots on the system board. On older computers you had ISA slots, which are the industry standard architecture slots. Very few system boards ship with ISA slots these days. You had EISA, which was supposed to be an enhanced ISA. That's also very rare. In the old days you had Visa Local Bus, which you probably won't have to deal with. These days you tend to deal with PCI, PCI Express, and AGP, and they are the most common slots that you'll get. PCI being Peripheral Component Interconnect, PCI Express being a souped-up version of that with different size slots for the different speeds of the PCI Express, and the AGP, which stands for Advanced Graphics Port. There are multiple versions of the AGP socket, but it just so happens that most graphics cards these days are PCIe, so you shouldn't have to worry too much with AGP. It is important to ensure that you get the correct graphics cards for the correct slots, otherwise the Meccano set that is your computer will not fit together. Some would argue you can avoid all of this by going and buying a Mac. Well, you can, but if ever you want to upgrade the Mac yourself, you'll need to concern yourself with the slots and stuff, unless you want to pay the Apple Store lots to do it for you. Okay, any questions on all of that? Jolly good. Now, is there anybody who hasn't yet read the Discovery 1 Module 1 notes? So, everybody has read all of their notes. That's good to hear. We would like to see everybody have read Chapter 1 by now. If you haven't read Chapter 1 by now, and you're studying Discovery, in the next week would be a really good time to do it. Has anybody had any trouble accessing the curriculum with standard screen readers and Windows/Mac? Jolly good. Just checking, because we sometimes get some people who have trouble with their Flash, or some people have been paranoid and turned off all their cookies or disabled their JavaScript, and then they wonder why things don't actually function. Okay, the next sort of devices we are going to talk about the next thing we're going to talk about is storage. I have a funny story about that, which I will tell some people afterwards about being a JAWS user. Can anybody give me examples of storage drives? Yeah, we have disk drives, we have solid state devices.
Tape drive.
tape drives and flash drives, zip drives and CD-ROMs. Okay, jolly good. They're all different sorts of storage devices and floppy disks. Now, I would say that RAID isn't a storage type. It's a way of arranging storage to provide fault tolerance or increased speed. A RAID standing for Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disk Drives. And there is a good article you can read on that at Wikipedia if you are so inclined. Note that RAID protects your data from the loss of a device or two, depending on how you set up the RAID. It does not protect you from user error. It also does not protect you from your server being hit by lightning. So don't load all of your data onto a RAID array and believe that it's safe as houses. That's not likely to help much. You are talking to somebody who managed to crash an entire RAID array last year, and luckily I had copied all the data onto another server about 3 days beforehand, so I only lost about 2 gig of data. But that just goes to prove that you shouldn't be talking to your girlfriend when you are reshaping and reconfiguring RAID arrays from the command line. Moving right along. Okay, now these are we tend to call these devices storage devices, and we use them to store our files and our programs and all of that sort of stuff. Now, okay, so we just had some local students turn up for the fundy visit that... Okie dokie. Now, peripheral devices. Can we have some examples of peripherals, guys? Printers and scanners. Okay, yep. Monitors? Yeah, I suppose you'd call them... Mice, yes. Or mouses. Embossers, yes, that's a peripheral device. Okay, and they are devices that are...
Quite a lot of use of external audio devices and external hard drives.
Yeah, braille displays, external keyboards, external hard drives, it's all good. They're all peripheral devices. You could argue that a peripheral device is a device that is connected external to your computer and is out on the outside sort of thing of your computer, out in the periphery, and it is not required for computer operation, is the definition that is given.
This maybe compares a bit. How would you define operation?
We're going to get rid of the filing cabinets. That's a work in progress.
Sorry, I missed that question. Andrew?
Yeah, that was me.
Comment?
Hopefully this
might
sorry. To continue to be useful. Yeah, I was wondering, how do you define operation? Because, for example, my USB audio card isn't required for the computer to function, but I still used to need it in order to use it.
Well, the point is that it's connected externally to a computer, and the computer could actually function without it, as in the computer... It doesn't mean that you can use it, it just means that the computer could actually operate. And whilst you could argue that a monitor is not required for a blind person to use their computer, I'd like you to... I've actually seen a lot of blind people who thought they could skimp $100 or $200 on not having a monitor, and boy, oh boy, was their unhappiness when they needed to get a sighted person to fix the computer. And, of course, it can be a bit difficult if you don't have a monitor, although there are certain situations where you use servers and things and you log in and you log into them remotely, and you don't have to have monitors for those, generally speaking. Or you can use KVMs to share one monitor between multiple computers, which means you can still save bits of money and not actually have stacks of monitors. It says here, case and power supply, discuss. Well, I did that last week in ITE1, and I think most of you were here for that. We talked about things going bang and the smoke coming out. But in a nutshell, the power supply is designed to take... AC from the wall and convert it into 5, 12, and 3.3 volts for your computer. My silly microphone decided to cut out there. And those voltages are used by the various components in your computer. Generally speaking, 5 volts is used for the logic, 3 volts is used for the low power stuff for the CPU and the RAM, and 12 volts is used to run fans and... I'm just going to go and drop my sensitivity because this is cutting out a bit too much. Okie dokie, that should be significantly better. Yes, I made funny noises, so I'm glad we all remember that. And we're not going to make those funny noises again today. Just to disappoint you all. So your case has got to be the right form factor. You've got to have a power supply that can go in your case. Generally speaking, you need to have space behind your computer if you're running the average power supply, because there is a fan in the back of the power supply, and the fan is responsible for removing heat from the power supply. And if that fan stops or becomes inoperable or has too much stuff shoved behind it, it can get too hot and then the power supply can go bang. Has anyone seen those stupid computer desks where you slide the tower in and then there's a thing across the back of them, so that not only can't you get any cables into the back of your computer, but you can't actually cool the thing down either?
I have an entertainment cabinet like that.
Kieran can recreate your accounts and stuff. Yep. Okay, so they're really insane. I don't know who designed those computer desks, but you drill holes and stuff. It just makes life a bit easier. Now, the other thing we're talking about is a surge suppressor and an UPS. Can anybody tell me what either one of those is? An uninterruptible power supply. Yes, that's what an UPS does. Can anybody tell me what it does?
Provides battery backup in order for you to shut down the computer, give you time to do that. The other is just to protect a surge protector, to protect a surge in voltage.
Yes, and as part of ITE1, you get to learn about surges, spikes, sags, brownouts, and blackouts. And they're in your test. Okay? So, a surge is an increase in voltage that lasts for a reasonable amount of time. A spike is a very brief increase in voltage. A sag is a decrease in voltage. A brownout is a loss of power for a very short time. And a blackout is a complete loss of power. But that's ITE1, so don't worry too much about that in Discovery. You are correct, the uninterruptible power supply, well, in fact, there are two different sorts of uninterruptible power supplies. There's a standby power supply and there is an uninterruptible power supply. Now, the difference between a standby power supply and an uninterruptible power supply is that an uninterruptible power supply runs the load off the batteries at all times. And when the power drops, the batteries stop being charged, thereby the batteries then start to deplete as they run the equipment, which is then cleanly shut down. So with a standby power supply, however, the mains are run directly through to your... what was what called again?
With the battery in line all the time.
That is the uninterruptible power supply. Now, and so the uninterruptible power supply doesn't have any dips or drops out when the power drops. Now, the standby power supply runs the mains straight through, usually through sort of a smoothing transformer to deal with voltage dip and buck. When the power goes out, there is a relay that clicks across, and you'll hear an audible click, and then the inverter will start working and running the load off the batteries. And Jenny has connected, so good stuff. Don't forget that now that you've recreated all the users, unless you've edited her files, she'll have lost all of her hotkeys and stuff. So it'll be set to left control by default. Okie dokie. So, and so you'll often find that uninterruptible power supplies are more expensive than standby power supplies, because it is more expensive to actually run the load off the batteries completely, because you're running the inverter all the time, whereas most PC power supplies can stand a 1 or 2 millisecond drop in voltage because they're switch mode power supplies, so having the relay flick across doesn't generally cause a problem. Although some ADSL modems and stuff are sensitive to that, and we used to have a problem where with one of our older modems, whenever the air conditioner would cut in, the ADSL would drop out, which wasn't very useful. Okay, any other questions on any of that so far, or any things, any stories, anecdotes people want to add in? I know, you're all looking for Grace to come in so that it becomes more interactive rather than me rabbiting on.
Will you tell me what RAID stands for again?
Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disk Drives.
I thought that was Redundant Array of Individual Disks.
Depends on who you talk to, and in fact, if you look up the Wikipedia article, there are 4 different expansions. Pick your favourite. Anyway, so... redundant array of inexpensive, incredibly unreliable, I don't know, it depends, whatever you want it to be, but I tend to go for inexpensive because that's what the drive manufacturers would like you to think, redundant array of inexpensive disk drives. Independent, no, I wouldn't necessarily say independent because often you run them off the same power supply or off the same motherboard controller, and I wouldn't necessarily say that they were completely independent. So have a look at en.wikipedia.org, key in RAID into the search box, and it will give you the expansions that you might want. Otherwise, fire up a copy of Google and type in define colon RAID into the search box. Okay, any other questions, comments? This is true, and in fact the Wikipedia article says as much. When it was first used, drives weren't cheap, but it was thought that the increased data protection or the increased speed was worth the cost. I remember when our local Roads and Transit Authority bought network cards back in 1990, an Ethernet card with a 10Base2 connector, which is the old coax connectors with T-pieces and that sort of thing. They were $1,500 a card.
How much storage were you talking?
Sorry, how much storage for the network card? We're talking network cards here. These network cards were full-length ISA cards, and they had an 80186 processor on them, and they were able to run 2 protocols at once under DOS, IPX, and TCP/IP, which was unusual for the time. That's why they were so expensive. They're actually an Exos 205 network card, but that's neither here nor there. Okie dokie, I need to talk about safety and static precautions and workspace and all of the good stuff we cover in ITE 1. And Jenny's saying she's been here before, she's having a sense of deja vu over here, as my friend's sister used to say. Safety. Look, I'd really refer you to your notes, but essentially don't do anything stupid. Don't climb on a ladder by yourself. Don't play with live power cables. Make sure you've got adequate lighting. Make sure you've got adequate ventilation. Make sure that you are not going to lift 20 kilos with your back that can't lift 20 kilos just because you want to try and get workers' comp, but then if workers' comp ever finds out, you won't. Don't do things that are going to deliberately put yourself in danger. One of the controversial safety points is don't power up a computer with the lid off. Okay, that's what the notes say. Okay, so if they ask you, don't power up a computer with the lid off. Now I will tell a story about a stupid mistake I made one night, just so that we can all be aware of it, and perhaps messing with your computer while it has the lid off and it is turned on is not a good look. I was listening to Terry Pratchett's The Colour of Magic while working on my brand new computer system, and I was messing around inside the case, and I managed to stick my fingers onto a spinning fan and broke broke one of the blades off the fan. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, I was also trying to socket said fan onto the CPU, and this was an old socket 478, and I was trying to get the screwdriver wedged into one of those really strongly spring-loaded clips, and I was jamming down with the screwdriver to try and clip it over the edge of the sticky out bit on the socket, and I snapped the little sticky out bit off the socket. So that was a $200 worth of motherboard that was then unusable. So if you're going to work on your computer when it's powered up and has the lid off, don't be listening to Terry Pratchett, and be very, very careful, and don't ever say you did in the test, because it is an occupational health and safety risk. They're okay, actually. Luckily, it was a low-spinning fan. One of the problems with some of the fans that spin at 6,800 RPM is if you actually stick your finger in one of those, it's actually possible for it to chop the top of your finger off. So don't do it. Can anybody... I actually would disagree on that. I learned a lot of lessons about what not to do with computers that were powered up, and I'm certainly a lot more careful with my hardware, but you'll have just have to take my word for that. And here comes Grace, who's just managed to turn up. Okie dokies. Now, can anybody tell me what static electricity is? It is a brief discharge of current. Can anybody give me an example of things that cause static electricity?
Carpet, but... Whoa, that was creepy.
Okay, we have hair. We have carpet. We have cats. So yes, don't pat Moggy while you're fixing the computer. In fact, a good way to generate static electricity is rubber and wool, or an ebony rod and cat's fur, or a glass rod and silk. Generally, there are electrons that are displaced by the friction. Balloons. So yes, you can use wool and balloons to generate static electricity. There's another thing that generates static electricity. What generates big amounts of static electricity? And it makes a loud noise. Yes, your guide dog in a dry climate could make a big noise. I'll give you that one. But generally, you don't want your guide dog to make a big noise. But yes, thunder and lightning, big forms of static electricity. Now, static electricity can be damaging to electronic components. The voltages in static electricity can damage your components, so use an anti-static wrist strap. Make sure you equalize the potential between you and the case. Also, make sure that you unplug your case from the wall in case somebody's miswired your PowerPoints and things. Static electricity. I think there's a question in the IT1 exam as to how many volts you can have before you can feel a static discharge. And I think it's 10,000. Is that right? Yeah, I think 3,000. 3,000 volts. 3,000 volts. Yes. 3,000 volts. But if you're the sort of person who runs around with some sort of meter measuring how many volts you get every time you step out of the car and zap yourself, I'd be suggesting that perhaps you need a hobby.
Could you tell him how many it takes to hurt a computer?
It only takes about 30 volts to hurt computer. So 30 volts can hurt your computer. Well, unfortunately, Jonathan, if the one unused item in your toolbox is a wrist strap, we would be wondering as to whether we're going to give you a certificate. I'd strongly recommend that you do use a wrist strap, because I actually have seen components experience static damage, and if you're working on components that you can't afford to replace, a wrist strap is a good idea. But I do agree that there are far too many technicians that certainly take the whole static risk as a blasé thing, and they just jam the components in and hope for the best. Okie dokie. Now. Now, static precautions, we talked about that quite extensively. As I said, don't pat the cat while you're fixing your computer. We also found that a lot of rooms and stuff are carpeted, and a lot of people wear sand shoes and stuff. It's probably a good idea, if you've got them, to use anti-static mats and to ground anti-static mats where possible. I'm supposed to talk about installing new components. Basically, that involves reading all of the documentation. No, you didn't read the documentation, did you? You've already ripped it out of the box and twiddled with every switch on it, jammed it in the slot, found it didn't work, and then resorted back to reading the documentation. Seriously, there can be useful stuff in the documentation, so warm that scanner up and get reading, or Google up some PDFs. Bit of software that I bought, which I really, really like, and I'll advertise just because I like it so much, is Nuance PDF Converter, which you can basically go right-click and convert to Word document, and blam, out comes a Word document that is generally readable, and it is insanely good, and it does OCR on inaccessible PDFs. And Grace loves it, and Jenny loves it. So Nuance PDF Converter, great bit of kit. You still can. Nobody will buy it, Jenny. Okay.
I think FineReader makes something like that too.
ABBI, Abby FineReader does do it. However, the Nuance one is just about transparent, and it's fairly cheap, and it is very quick. Okay, and PDF Equalizer is good to convert to MP3. I personally don't do that because you can't control the rate of the speech. I tend to convert to a flat file and then dump it onto the Victor Stream or whatever. Yes, PDF to TXT is also very good, and JAML's got a good version of PDF to TXT, and the newer versions do have a limited form of OCR in them.
I haven't had much success with the OCR on that, but if it's just regular text, then it works great.
We could have a whole Thursday chat on PDF, okay? And we might do that, although I just heard a rumour that, and if this happens, we have one of our people that used to help out in the old Cisco stuff when we used to do it in the early days, and he's going to give a talk every second Friday on the stuff he's been working on. So I believe that we are going to have the Friday morning thing, or the Thursday evening as far as you guys are concerned, is going to be a semi-regular thing, and we are going to have some informed people talking about different things on the Ventrilo server, and they of course will be recorded and placed on this server.
Yeah.
Now, that ends lecture one. Now, I don't know whether Grace is geared up to do a quiz quite yet.
She is. She's got to open the file very quickly, and we can do that. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
Now, just a reminder, the payment deadline is supposedly March 1st. If you haven't paid, please think about it. So, if you haven't paid, it's going to be time to pay soon. You pay by clicking on the donate link on www.qcat.org. And in fact, if you like our program, you can actually donate more money than what we ask for. We'd never stop you from doing that. In fact, you can donate as much money as you want. But we do want your course fees, hopefully, by the 1st of March, if possible. Otherwise, we start asking people why they haven't paid, and we will start emailing and nicely asking you.
And if you need a payment plan, no shame in that. Email us and we will help you out with the payment plan. Don't wait till the last minute. Please let us know what you need and we will work with you.
Okay, I'm just going to go turn AutoVox off so that Grace can... I suppose... they can understand you.
Hey, am I hearable? Sounds like I'm doing just
yes,
fine.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Very sorry that
Really, I am. Stop laughing, Jenny.
For those who don't know, Grace's dress tore at Bassendean, and her shoulder strap was torn, and she had to go home and get a different dress because that would not have been cool. So she's been doing the public transport run around and has only just arrived, but we are happy to see her nonetheless.
Yeah, it was good. Okay, so, okay, yep.
Well, we're glad to have you back.
Okay, so, if everybody can get in their chat windows, the quiz works multiple choice answers, and, there we go. Now that should...
How does Chris say?
Loud and clear, Chris.
Can you hear me? You can hear me?
Very loudly.
Yes.
Yeah, it comes through pretty loud.
So you just type in a letter, and whatever you think the correct answer is. It really doesn't matter if you get it wrong. This is just practice. No one's...
Okay. And am I audible, people?
Yeah, yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I am out, but I'm still... Yeah, that'll do. Okay, everybody. So, if we can get into chat windows. All right, question one. A company requires high-end computer that can store significant amounts of files and process applications. Which two components are the most critical for the computer performance? Choose two. A, RAM. B, CPU card.
C, video card.
D, sound card. And E, a modem. Choose two.
Go drop your sensitivity down a bit further. Yes, and the answers would be A and B. Well done. Now, what we generally tend to do is, once we've asked the question, we then tell you when to answer so that you can all type it in and then press enter when we say so, so that you don't inadvertently advantage your other classmates. But don't trust everybody else's answers because they might be wrong. So it doesn't really matter.
And you know what? Later on, they usually are wrong. So it's okay. Okay. Question two. A peripheral is a storage device that connects to the USB interface and allows files to be saved and moved between computers. Which one is it? Is it A, a modem, B, a scanner, C, a printer, D, a flash drive, or E, a network card? Go now.
And my e-speaker's just gone...
Who would have thought it?
My e-speaker's just gone d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d, which says you're all right.
Okay, question three. Which component provides backup power to a computer system for a short period of time? Is it A, CPU, B, modem, C, surge suppressor, D, uninterruptible power supply? Answer now. Think it might be D, guys. You're right.
It's a cool rhythm going on.
It is kind of cool, isn't it? Alright, question four. Which term describes static electricity that can be transferred from your body to electronic components in the computer? Is it A, voltage surge, B, voltage spike, C, grounding, D, surge suppressor, or E, electrical status discharge? Answer now. Oh, gotcha.
Chris was just being silly by going ESDDDD just to confuse people. Okay, let's move on to the next question of the quiz before things go completely insane in here.
Okay, we've got question five. What two examples of input-only peripheral devices? Choose two. Is it A, printer, B, scanner, C, joystick, D, flash drive, E, external NIC, or F, monitor? Choose two. Okay, for anyone who is curious, the answers are B and C, a scanner and a joystick. A flash drive can also output because you can transfer a file to it.
But does that mean if you've got force feedback on your joystick, it's a bidirectional device, just to be pedantic?
You know what I'd think, so I would have written the question differently, but hey. Yeah,
Don't panic, that's just a test.
It's not them.
Yeah, we don't have to get scared yet.
Okay, question six. A small real estate company with one office wants to purchase a computer to use for file storage. What type of computer would be the best choice? Would that be an A, a mainframe computer, B, standalone server, C, rack mount server, D, workstation, or E, blade server? Go now.
Or F, the server that you pay Kerry and Grace lots of money to build.
That one. Everybody choose F. So does this one is kind of interesting. Does anybody... Does anybody want to talk about why they chose... Well, we'll just have a couple people, possibly, because we do have a little bit of time. Does anyone want to talk about why they chose the answer they did?
I chose black because it sounds cool.
Sorry.
Not you, Chris.
I chose rack mount because my thought was that you wouldn't need to move it around very much. I'm not entirely sure what a blade server is. Maybe we talked about that last week and I missed it, but...
The key word is small, isn't it? Whereas a rack mount is a fairly large TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they only want one of them, so there's no point having a 19-inch whopping rack when you've got lots of stuff stuck in it. So, standalone.
Standalone is correct.
Standalone is correct.
Good job, Jenny. Oh, good.
And then the way we get Chris to change his answer away from Blade is telling him that he's paying for it, and then he gets paying this cheaper.
What was the correct legend?
No, well, nobody could teach Chris.
What letter was it?
That would be... Oh, yeah, I think you're right, too, B. These don't actually have letters, so I'm just making the letters up as I go, because they don't, you know, conveniently put them there for me, so, yeah. Okay, question 7. User opens an application and sends a message to a friend in another country. What type of application has been used? A local, graphics, network, standalone? A, B, C, D, answer now. And that is absolutely correct. It's a network application. It goes over the network. Good job, everybody.
Run, network, run.
We actually have a lot of, just so that people know, we've got a whole lot of, I don't want to use the word old students because they'll bash me up when I go to break, ex-students who are young at heart. We have, just so people know who's sitting in here, we've got Trevor and we have Jenny. And Trevor is one of our students and Jenny is his better half.
Jenny studied with me last year.
Yes, she was. She's a student as well. And we also have Gordon in here, who's not mic'd up at the moment, and Chris Legg, who's usually the one who replies with a vaguely humorous comment on Cavi Discuss from time to time, in relation to alcohol. And I think that's about all the extras we've got in here at the moment, I think.
Josh is here today, isn't he?
And we have a new person working with us now who got Geraldine's old job, and that is Josh. No, we all pay for our morning tea.
Okay, on to question 8. Now, this is a little different because it's not going to be as multiple choice. Your choices here are going to be workstation and server. So either type it in or W or S, whatever you want to do. So we have to decide which of the statements applies to a workstation or a server. So it's one. Okay. Used for virtual reality simulations, normally secured in a room. Yeah. And honestly, for this one, you could take both. Because either one could really... They're so closely knitted together that it really could be either one. So good job, guys.
Everybody, we have guests here just so people know, because you can't see the guests turn up, but they're currently being introduced around, so they're not live yet.
Which one would have powerful graphics utilities? Absolutely correct, everybody. All right, next one. Usually has redundant components, such as hard drives.
Okay, that is a server. Go on, Grace.
It is a server. I'm sorry. I was just trying to see if I was needed.
No, okay. You're not.
All right. Runs high-end applications like engineering programs. That would probably be a workstation, but it could be a server.
You don't tend to run applications on a server.
It's running the application. The server may host an application like that over a network, but it probably... Okay. Provide services to multiple clients. Absolutely. That would be S. Okay. We're back with the multiple choice. What measurement is commonly associated with graphics resolution? Is it A, HZ, B, capital M, capital B, C, capital G, capital B, lowercase BPS, or pixels?
Which would be E.
Which would be E. Absolutely. And I don't believe we're going to question 10 because it's matching, and it could be a really difficult unless you just want me to ask people to define these terms. So let me know. People want to have a go at it? Okay. Actually, I'm just going to review the definitions. I'm going to read the definitions, and you guys can tell me what they are. It's, it is units of measuring data. So we've got a bit, a byte, a kilobyte, a megabyte, a gigabyte, and a terabyte. So here we go. Approximately 1,000 bytes, which is it?
Yes, it's actually a kilobyte as opposed to a kibibyte. I wasn't going to pick out
and say megabyte, but if you... kilobytes.
1,000 bytes is a kilobyte.
Oops, I thought you said kilobytes. My bad.
That's why we do this, so that you remember and you get a chance to get it wrong before you take the real test. Okay, what's approximately 1 trillion bytes?
And that would be a terabyte.
That would be a terabyte.
Just for the recording.
That's right. Okay, so what is approximately 1 million bytes? There you go, Rosie. There's your megabyte. That is absolutely correct. Okay, and approximately 1 billion bytes? Okay. And that's it.
So what was it?
It was gigabyte. Congratulations, you all survived your first quiz. You should be very proud of yourself. It usually doesn't go that well. Good job.
Okay, now what's happening at the moment is the guest is still being talked at by our boss, and we'll see if they're going to bring him on Ventrilo in a bit or not. So just hang about. Has anybody got any questions or issues they would like to raise from the lecture that has gone? Otherwise, I can hit stop on the recording.